Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, June 3rd, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. On this telephone conference call, we'll be discussing the opinion handed down earlier today in the U.S. Supreme Court case Maryland v. King. In that decision, the court upheld the Maryland statute allowing for collection of DNA samples of mere arrestees. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome back to our call two attorneys, John L. Wood and John Malcolm. As always, their bios have been provided to you in the flyers for today's call, and they're also available on our website. So I'll be brief in my introduction. I think all you need to know about John Elwood is that he's a partner at Vincent Elkins Law Firm here in Washington, D.C. He also hosted our Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum when Maryland v. King was originally argued. And I don't know, John Elwood, if you made a prediction at that time, but maybe we'll all go back and listen to the original podcast recording of that, see how you predicted the outcome to be. In any event, he's going to give us some background on the case and then talk about the decision. And after his opening remarks, we'll hear comments from John Malcolm. Mr. Malcolm is Senior Legal Fellow in the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And he is also the chairman of the Federalist Society's Criminal Law Practice Group. And with that, Mr. Elwood, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Sounds good. Well, I'll start by noting my prediction. My recollection of my prediction is that I predicted that the state would probably win, but that it was going to be close. And I guess fortunately for me, but not so fortunately for Alonzo King, my prediction turned out to be correct. Some background on the case. In April 2009, Alonzo King was arrested and charged with first and second degree assault for allegedly pointing a shotgun at a group of people. The first-degree charge was later dropped, but while it was pending, it qualified King for DNA testing under Maryland's DNA Collection Act. Although King didn't dispute his involvement in the assault, state personnel swabbed the inside of his cheek to collect a DNA specimen and sent it off to a private lab for matching. Nearly 4 months later, his DNA was matched to an unsolved 2003 rape. His first-degree assault charge that qualified him for DNA testing was later dropped, but he pleaded guilty to second-degree assault, which was an offense that wouldn't have qualified him for DNA testing. But based on the DNA testing that was done while the charge was pending, King was charged with first-degree rape, convicted, and he's serving a life sentence without possibility of parole. Every state in the federal government collects DNA from persons convicted of certain felonies, and the constitutionality of such statutes has routinely been upheld. Maryland is one of a growing number of jurisdictions, 27 states in the federal government the last time I checked, that requires the routine collection of DNA samples from people merely arrested for specified serious offenses. Maryland's DNA collection statute contains several procedural protections that the others do not. The DNA is not tested until after there has been a judicial determination of probable cause, and if the person is not convicted, the DNA sample is then destroyed, although any identification that happens during the interim can still be the subject of a prosecution. Maryland's highest court previously upheld the constitutionality of the Maryland DNA Collection Act as applied to convicted felons, but in King's appeal, it said it wouldn't countenance application of the act to arrestees. The court said that the state had no need to identify King since it had already identified him and had no need for a DNA sample to be confident of who it had arrested. Writing for the majority today, which consisted of himself, the Chief Justice, and Justices Thomas, Breyer, and Alito, Justice Kennedy, who was fairly outspoken in his support of the state, says this case, quote, can be addressed against the background, unquote, of the so-called special needs cases. But it kind of, like many Justice Kennedy opinions, it was a little loosey-goosey on what doctrinal box it fit into. It said, well, the special needs cases were in full accord with the result reached here. They don't have a direct bearing on the issues presented in this case because unlike in the special needs cases, which involve citizens who have, this case involves someone who has been suspected of a wrong, and the special needs cases are people who are not so suspected, and this case involves people who have a diminished expectation of privacy. Recall that the special needs cases are typically for searches that don't advance the ordinary need for law enforcement. They're things like drug testing student athletes and things like that. Justice Kennedy wrote that the search could be justified like a routine administrative procedure at a police station house, such as fingerprinting or things like that, or photographing them, where the law is already in the act of subjecting the accused to its dominion, where they have a diminished expectation of privacy. The majority reasoned that DNA identification plays a critical role in serving the state's interests and removing an individual from the normal channels of society and holding him in legal custody, and then gave five reasons at some length why that is the case. They said, first, it's because it's knowing a suspect's criminal history is a critical part of his identity that officers should know when processing him for detention. And they said it was no different in that regard than matching a person to a photograph or a fingerprint. The dissent later, said a photograph isn't a Fourth Amendment violation at all. But as an aside, I think forcing someone to sit for a photograph is a seizure of them during the pendency of that. Same with fingerprinting. Second, law enforcement officers bear a responsibility for ensuring that the custody of an arrestee doesn't create inordinate risks of staff. They must know the type of person whom they're detaining. And, if the person is a serial killer who's wanted in a bunch of other cases, you're going to treat him differently and more carefully than if the guy is Jimmy Stewart. Third, they have an interest in ensuring that the person is available for trial, and a person who knows that there are undiscovered crimes in their past is less likely to appear, particularly because every state tests convicts for DNA. And so they hypothesized that if a person knows that there are other crimes in their past, they're going to skip rather than appearing for trial, unless you know who they are before you release them. Fourth, they wrote, an arrestee's past conduct is essential to an assessment of the danger he poses to the public, and this will inform a court's determination whether the individual should be released on bail. Now, I'm going lickety-split, and I kind of apologize for that, but there's a lot of ground to cover. I'm going to slow down here to read one of the quotes that really struck me while I was reading this, because I think in some ways the majority may be going farther than they intend to here. They wrote, quote, regardless of when the initial bail decision is made, release is not appropriate until a further determination is made as to the person's identity in the sense not only of what his birth certificate states, but also what other records and data disclose to give that identity more meaning in the whole context of who the person really is. And even when release is permitted, the background identity of the suspect is necessary for determining what conditions must be met before release is allowed, unquote. I think it will be interesting to see whether that makes it all the way through into the final edition of the U.S. reports, because it certainly seems to suggest that police who arrest somebody shouldn't let them go until the DNA testing is complete. And that wasn't, I think that frequently that is not the case. I think in many cases somebody may be bonded out routinely, and they might have to call him back if it turns out the guy's a serial killer. Finally, the fifth point, identification of the arrestee as a perpetrator of a heinous crime, the court said may have the salutary effect of freeing wrongfully imprisoned people. Echoing Justice Alito's comments at argument, the majority suggested that DNA testing was the 21st century equivalent of fingerprinting. It said it wasn't constitutionally germane that it took DNA a while to be processed. As I say, it was weeks and weeks in this case, whereas fingerprinting is more or less a very rapid thing, almost instantaneous. And they noted that fingerprinting used to take some time in the past until the FBI computerized the databases. They noted that the FBI has already begun testing devices that will enable DNA testing within 90 minutes. And the court emphasized towards the tail end of its opinion the minimal intrusion given the lack of pain in such testing and the lack of risk to the person. And the fact that the person's expectation of privacy was already significantly reduced by the fact that they were being processed in to the criminal justice system. One thing that I thought was noteworthy for a Justice Kennedy opinion was the lack of qualifying or narrowing language. He's well known for including language in his opinions, limiting its application, and trying to observing the risks that could be present in this case. And the only such thing that was that they mentioned here was that the majority said, well, science can always progress further, and those progressions may have Fourth Amendment consequences. They mentioned that specifically in the context of the fact that what what the portions of the DNA that are tested here are what is called junk DNA, in the sense that it doesn't say anything about what you look like as a person. It doesn't say whether you're going to have certain diseases. All it says is pretty much is that you are a particular person. And that was about the only limitation I saw. Originally, Orrin Kerr, I noted in my original talk, he painted this as basically a fight between the two blocks of the court, the reasonableness people versus the bright line people who say, you know, there's a general prohibition against suspicionless searches and you got to have an exception for it. The majority fell clearly in the reasonableness camp. It wasn't super tidy doctrinally, and it you know, seemed to be alike a lot of things, but not strictly in any category. But it all came down to reasonableness in the final analysis. Justice Scalia, true to form, did this as a bright line rule, saying that the Fourth Amendment forbids searching persons for evidence of crime when there's no basis for believing the person is guilty of the crime or is in possession of incriminating evidence, you know, barring a, you know, specific exemption, and they said, or a specific exception, and they said he didn't fall on any specific exceptions. He noted that this was largely, that the majority relied heavily on this sort of identification rationale, writing that both the legitimacy of the court's method and the correctness of the outcome hinge entirely on the truth of a single proposition, that the primary purpose of these DNA searches is something other than simply discovery of evidence of criminal activity, unquote. But he said that that proposition is wrong, and then went on at some length to note how, or to explain how, this had nothing to do with identification in the traditional sense and had everything to do with solving cold cases. They noted that the DNA, you know, wasn't sent to some identification unit. It was sent to essentially the cold case unit to be tested against unknown samples. Justice Scalia ended by saying that, quote, the court disguises the vast and scary scope of its holding by promising a limitation it cannot deliver. And the limitation is that this is for people arrested of serious offenses. But Justice Scalia wrote, I cannot imagine what principle could justify that limitation, and the court does not attempt to suggest any. If one believes that DNA will identify someone arrested for assault, he must believe that it will identify someone arrested for a traffic charge, unquote. He anticipated there a time would come where, you know, there'd be a case testing the constitutionality of taking DNA from someone stabbed for a traffic offense, and he thought the court would then say that they could find no significant difference between this case and King. And I think, incidentally, that is a reference to Trevino versus Thaler, which was decided last week, where Justice Scalia's almost his entire dissent was just to say, I told you so, pointing out that he didn't think that the court's limitation that adopted that day back in 2012 would hold up, and indeed one term later it didn't. One thing I do think is kind of interesting, you know, for the Parade of Horribles, which I didn't see, I reviewed it rather quickly in preparing for this, that I didn't see the majority, or rather dissent, pick up on, is the majority did note at page 12 of the slip opinion that, quote, it is common occurrence that people detained for minor offenses can turn out to be the most devious and dangerous criminals, unquote, noting Timothy McVeigh, Joel Rifkin, both of whom were picked up during traffic stops, and the fact that one of the 9/11 terrorists had been stopped for speeding the day of the attack. I think that's interesting, since it tends to, you know, support the majority, or rather the dissenters' parade of horribles, but I didn't see that they dissenters had picked up on that. I do think, however, that the rationale does seem to turn on the fact that it's a minimal additional intrusion, and I think that's a harder thing to say about a person who stopped for a traffic stop versus someone who is being booked into jail. Although I suppose, you know, the thing is, you can get a custodial arrest for a traffic offense. The court determined in that, in just that case written by Justice Souter. But you know, when you're booked into jail, which generally doesn't happen for traffic stops, you can be subject to a full strip search, as the court recently decided in the Florence case. And so I think that there is a strong case to be made that being booked into custody is a greater, you know, you already have a diminished expectation of privacy compared with those who are subject to a traffic stop. And with that, we'll end my first round of yammering, and now I turn you over to John Malcolm, who will embarrass me by seeming much more organized than I am. John, over to you.
I think it'll be tough to top that remarkably cogent and thorough summary. I'll just add a few thoughts. I really think that the court came down to the idea that since Maryland limited the statute to arrest for serious offenses, and there was probable cause to arrest the person, that once that person was in lawful custody, that they had a diminished expectation of privacy, which clearly impacted the court's analysis, and the fact that the intrusion in this case was negligible, involving a swab of a person's cheek, and because the intrusion was so minimal, and because the person was in valid police custody, the majority felt that there was no need for any kind of individualized suspicion, that you could just look at this under a general reasonableness factor. I think they then spent, as John said, a remarkable amount of time talking about the state's legitimate interest in identifying arrestees, pointing out that fingerprinting has been used recently for this task, but the DNA is a significant improvement upon fingerprinting, and saying, look, this is really no different from taking a photograph of someone who's arrested and comparing it to a wanted poster, or looking at tattoos of somebody who's arrested and identifying those tattoos with somebody with a gang affiliation that may be wanted for an unsolved offense of some kind. I do think that the dissent did a very effective job of saying, look, if identity was the issue here, then, you know, the Maryland statute that set this DNA collection process in place doesn't say anything about that the purpose of this law is to be used for identifying arrestees. In fact, they talk about the purpose of the DNA collection is to investigate crimes. Scalia also pointed out in dissent that, if this were really about identifying arrestees, then the moment the swab is taken, you would send it off for testing. The Maryland statute says that you can't send the swab off for testing until arraignment. At arraignment, usually there's a probable cause determination made as to whether the case can continue. If probable cause is found after the arraignment, then you can submit the swab for analysis. However, bond decisions, which is what the majority spends a significant amount of time talking about, do you have the right defendant? What's their past criminal record? What should the bond recommendation be? Should they be placed in detention with people for other nonviolent offenses, or is there something hidden in the person's past that would indicate that that's an improper placement? Those decisions are all made at the arraignment. And so if you were really serious about this, then you would submit that sample prior to arraignment. The dissenters likened this to a general warrant, which were loved by our British forebears and despised by our founding fathers. And Scalia also goes on to point out not only that, as John said, the prediction is that this will apply in many run-of-the-mill cases in the future. Quoting from the dissent, he says, "Make no mistake about it. As an entirely predictable consequence of today's decision, your DNA can be taken and entered into a national DNA database if you are ever arrested, rightly or wrongly, and for whatever reason." The other thing the dissenters point out is saying that the application of this statute is going to apply to people who are most in need of Fourth Amendment protection. What he points out is, as John said, all states have recognized, and no one contests, that once you are convicted of a crime, the state can then take your DNA and compare it under the CODIS, which is the FBI's system, combined DNA index system, compare it to other unsolved crimes. However, in this case, it applies to arrestees. And so if somebody is arrested and ultimately acquitted of the crime, the evidence, the DNA is supposed to be destroyed. However, if there is an identification during that time period between the time of arraignment and the time of acquittal, then you can apply that DNA to solve past crimes. So in this case, they're saying, look, if this person were convicted, there's no question they could take the DNA and use it for whatever purposes, including investigations to other unsolved crimes. But here, the only application that makes a difference is to somebody who is ultimately acquitted of the offense for which the DNA was taken. And then, you know, to such a person who is innocent of that offense, the Fourth Amendment should have particular protections involved. and those were obviously set aside here. The one thing I would note is that this was a similar lineup with one notable switch, that being Justice Kennedy, to the Supreme Court's recent opinion involving DNA testing, or in this case, not DNA testing, blood testing in Missouri versus McNeely. So the court, by a 5-4 decision, recently said that there had to be a warrant requirement before doing a blood draw of somebody who was suspected of DUI. The switch here was Kennedy. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that a blood draw literally involves sticking a needle into somebody's arm, so there was a level of intrusiveness and trauma that was lacking with respect to the DNA cheek swab, and that appeared to be significant to Kennedy. With that, I'll open it up to questions.
Well, thank you very much. That was John Malcolm. Before we return to the audience to questions, John Elwood, do you have anything further you want to say, or should we turn right to the audience?
One thing, I will be very interested to see what Maryland does as a result of this, because, you know, I think some of their procedural protections were probably put in to try to protect people. To try to protect privacy with a view towards getting the constitutionality of this upheld. Since it was upheld on kind of an identification rationale rather than, a crime-solving rationale, I would be interested to see whether they get rid of this requirement that the test not be performed until after arraignment, or whether, you know, the fact that, Maryland is a relatively liberal jurisdiction means that they will keep it in even if it no longer seems to be constitutionally required. That'll be an interesting thing to see how that shapes up in the months and years ahead.
Very good. Well, let's check in with the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either John Malcolm or John Elwood, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting, let me make a programming announcement talking about the calls we have scheduled for the rest of the week. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., we'll be talking about who controls the Internet and what that means for national security, what the implications are for national security. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. On Friday at 1 p.m., we'll be talking with Jerry Wolpin and Professor Lillian Bevere, about Jerry Wolpin's new book, The Supreme Court versus the Constitution. Today we're talking to John Elwood, John Malcolm, about Maryland versus King. If you'd like to pose a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I enjoyed the discussion. Speaking as a former prosecutor, I had a case where a guy was arrested, had perfectly valid Florida driver's license. The police investigated further, found he also had another license with his photo, different name, that was a perfectly valid North Carolina driver's license. Turned out he had a passport, same picture, third name. When we're dealing with cases like this, obviously fingerprints are dispositive, but you have a sense of something broader afoot. And this is the sort of person who is most likely to skip the country or certainly skip the jurisdiction, and DNA may give you some means to track him.
I can jump in and address that. I'm also a former prosecutor, and I also had people appearing in court opposite me where identification was difficult. And I think what the majority said is, look, the difference between fingerprinting and DNA is that DNA is much better than fingerprinting. And in fact, the majority also went to great length to talk about the fact that while DNA testing is now slow, they are making great advances in that regard, and that DNA testing may become quite quick, akin to the time it takes to process a fingerprint. I think that the dissenters were very, very skeptical about that, saying, look, fingerprinting has worked pretty well for purposes of identification, so much so that any additional degree of accuracy that you get from DNA testing is negligible. And in fact, they said that anybody who takes the majority's assertion that DNA testing is really being used to identify arrestees, that argument, quote-unquote, taxes the credulity of the credulous. And they also went to great lengths to say, look, at the moment at least, DNA testing is a remarkably laborious process, that it takes days before an analyst will look at the DNA from the time that you submit it, and then it will take days afterwards for the testing results to be forwarded back. And so for the purposes that you just identified, which is to make a quick identification in court, DNA testing is very impractical and likely to remain impractical for some time.
Well, it's not necessary for quick. We may have to hunt the guy down once he skips. And there's also a question, fingerprints are, as a matter of course, sent to the cold case files. So they serve that function already.
Well, that is true. And in fact, the dissenter said, look, to the majority says that this is the same thing as photographs, not the same thing as photographs. Photographs don't involve any kind of an intrusion. And the dissenter said the majority also likens this to fingerprinting, and everybody accepts the constitutionality of fingerprinting. And the dissenter say, well, actually not quite so fast. This court has never opined specifically on that issue as to whether or not you can just take fingerprints willy-nilly without a warrant or suspicionless, warrantless fingerprinting. However, they recognize that a lot of courts have accepted this, that it is fairly routine, and that it's more closely linked to identification than DNA testing, although they do say that fingerprinting, like DNA testing, can also be used to link an arrestee to a cold case.
John Elwood, do you want to weigh in here?
Other than to note that I think this does kind of show why Justice Alito said that argument that, quote, this is the most important criminal procedure case this court has had in decades, unquote, because of its importance as an identification tool. It's interesting, you know, the court generally has been kind of slow to weigh in on new technologies, in that, you know, there have been some Fourth Amendment cases that have come close but haven't quite done it. We got a little bit more progress in that regard in the in the beeper case, the case of the GPS case that they had a couple
Jones.
But this term they have two DNA cases, this one and then the patentability of DNA. So you know they're having a DNA heavy term this term.
Are people starting to notice, or is it maybe my imagination that Justice Scalia is lining up pretty dependably with the defense side in a lot of these cases, even beyond the confrontation clause? And when you mention technology, it brings to mind the Kylo case, the heat sensing equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this term he's been on the defense side a lot. Is that correct, or is that my imagination, or is that beyond the scope of this?
I think that's right. You also saw that recently in the Fourth Amendment case, not only in Missouri versus McNeely, but also the dog sniff case, Jardines. I think that that when it comes to the Fourth Amendment, Justice Scalia has been a purist, if you will.
That's right. That's right. And that's the one thing, you know, commendably for him. You know, he goes where his principles take him, even if it winds up freeing somebody he doesn't think is a particularly good citizen. They talk about how admirable he talks at the end of his opinion about how admirable it is that DNA can solve crime, but he says it's, you know, it's not as admirable as the Fourth Amendment. But it is true. I think he is, you know, increasingly, obviously, what we call an available vote for, you know, people who represent criminal defendants in the Supreme Court. And I got a grant last Monday, and I definitely am hoping that his vote is available to me. So we will see. We can circle back in another year or so on that.
Yeah, you see that in the Sixth Amendment context, particularly with sort of child witnesses. He's a purist in terms of saying child witness is still a witness, you person's available for cross-examination. You obviously saw that with respect to the sentencing guidelines in Booker. And Scalia is definitely available, an available vote for those representing those who've been convicted of crimes. And congratulations, John, on your cert grant.
If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller in the queue right now. And before we go to the next caller, let me make another commercial announcement and invite folks to visit our website looking at our upcoming executive branch review conference next Tuesday, June 11th. That's here in Washington, D.C. What you won't find on the website just yet is a list of speakers that have been added for that conference. They include Senator Ted Cruz, Steve Bradbury, former head of the OLC, Tom Goldstein from SCOTUS blog, Professors Jonathan Adler, Robert Miller, and Stephen Cannon, Carol Davenport of the National Journal, and many others. That's our Executive Branch Review Conference next Tuesday, beginning at 9 a.m. at the Press Club. I think it's about three-quarters of a day and probably worth traveling. CLE credit will be available. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, my name is Daniel. I was hoping that somebody had recorded Scalia's oral dissent and that it might be available somewhere online or maybe on C-SPAN or something. Does anybody know whether that's available?
Probably check through SCOTUS blog, and my guess is that it will be. If it's not available now, it will be shortly. But, John, you might know better than I.
You know, that's a good question, but I honestly don't know. If it is available, it would be available, you know, on the court's website. They have a section for argument tapes, but I'm not aware of, you know, oral case announcement tapes or transcripts either. So I think, you know, the one thing about it is that I know that there must be some record of them because I know that there have been academic studies of the number of cases in which courts, or rather justices, dissent from the bench. And they can't do that without some sort of searchable record of it. So something must exist, but I don't know honestly what that is.
They do sometimes paraphrase their opinions, so perhaps they might be reluctant about having those recorded because they figure their opinion is their opinion, but I you can check.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, our lines are open now. If you have a question, this will be the last call for questions. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Give you your last opportunity to weigh in here and ask our experts a question. Star and then pound on your telephone. All right, gentlemen. Looks like, well, we do have one final question. Let's go to our next. Well, we had a question and then it disappeared. Let me give you each, you know, a minute or two to wrap up. If you have any final thoughts, if you want to pass, we can adjourn the call. But let's start with John Elwood and see if you have a final thought, John.
Well, I don't know if I have anything more to add other than the fact that I do think it is curious that that the majority went farther than I think they need to in suggesting that it would be improper to release a person who had been arrested of a felony before the DNA has been run against the database. And it will be interesting to see, as I say, it's always a worthwhile endeavor to check the preliminary prints, the slip opinions, versus the final version that winds up in the United States reports, because you would be surprised some of the things that get that wash out along the way. And I will be very interested to see if that winds up being rephrased, because if it makes it into the, you know, the final U.S. reports, it is, you know, something that they intended to do. And, you know, Justice Kennedy is putting his thumb on the scale and encouraging, you know, magistrates not to bond out people until they have their, you know, they have their DNA tested. They know exactly everything the person has done. John?
John Malcolm,
yeah.
A final thought?
Well, I agree with what John just said. I think it's hard to take that portion of the opinion seriously because it does take so long to get DNA test results back. I just got the impression when I read this, when the majority is citing to people like Timothy McVeigh who were arrested on traffic offenses and then are linked fairly quickly in that case through a driver's license, I mean the driver's plate, and also through the wanted poster to a more serious crime, that in this case the court was really just saying, look, this technology is so good at solving unsolved crimes, which is why they said that, you know, one of the benefits of this is that it'll occasionally result in somebody who's been wrongfully arrested or wrongfully convicted being released, that because this was such a minimally intrusive search and the benefits are so high to law enforcement that they were just going to find a way to uphold this. And it did.
Very good. On behalf of the Federalist Society, this is Dean Reuter. I want to thank especially for joining us on such short notice, both John Elwood and John Malcolm, for participating in our call today. And remind the audience again and invite you to join us for our call tomorrow at 2 p.m. when we'll be talking about who rules the Internet and what the answer to that question means for national security. It's 2 p.m. tomorrow. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.